to be roundly defeated by an establishment candidate like Mitt Romney. The white establishment is now the minority. And the voters, many of them, feel that this economic system is stacked against them, and they want stuff. You're going to see a tremendous Hispanic vote for President Obama. Overwhelming black vote for President Obama, and women will probably break President Obama's way. People feel that they are entitled to things, and which candidate between the two is going to give them things.
That was Bill O'Reilly, Tavis Smiley.
Yeah. Well, you asked a moment ago whether I was watching Fox on election night, and the answer is no. This is precisely why I wasn't watching Fox on election night. It's also why I don't watch a lot of MSNBC either. I don't like being spun to the right, and I don't like being spun to the left. What I prefer is to get at some truth, and that's why I appreciate Democracy Now! And other programs that are trying to get at the hard truths that Americans don't want to deal with. I don't know where to start in terms of deconstructing and dissecting what I just heard. I will tell you this. This is precisely why the Republicans lost. And if they think this is the narrative that's going to help them win into the future, then they need to put down the crack pipe. They're stuck on stupid if they think this strategy is a winning strategy. The reality is simply this, and you've discussed this on this program, so this is nothing new, obviously. In the most multicultural, multiracial, multi-ethnic America ever, that dog just won't hunt. If they cannot figure out a way to expand their base, the GOP is going down. Now, I don't like the two-party system. I surely don't want to live in a one-party state. So I appreciate competition. I wish there were more parties, obviously. But again, if this is the narrative they think they can sell to the American people to the future and help them win elections, I don't know what they're thinking. So this is it's tragic to listen to. It's really an echo chamber to our right, because this really sounds like Mitt Romney on the videotape that came out about the 47%.
Well, right-wing talk show host Rush Limbaugh recently claimed that President Obama and Vice President Biden want to grow the portion of the 47% who are, quote, wards of the state. This is from the October 9th edition of the Rush Limbaugh Show.
Whatever number of the 47% are wards of the state, they're happy. Not all that 47% wants to be in that group. But the people in the 47% who are content to be there, Biden, Obama would love to grow it. The more people dependent on government, the better. The more people angry, resentful of the rich, the better, as far as they're concerned.
Tavis Smiley.
Well, again, that if that's the kind of rhetoric that they're going to continue to engage in, go for it. I have no problem with Fox or Bill or Rush continuing to push that kind of agenda, because, again, it is not a winning strategy in this country to attack Hispanics, to attack African Americans, to attack women, to suggest that we're all a part of a welfare state, that we're all dependent on government. And in nowhere, at no point in either of those diatribes did you hear the truth, which is that the majority of Americans on welfare are white Americans. They are not black. They are not Hispanic. And so that truth just gets lost in the matrix. This was a campaign for the White House of extremes, a campaign of extremes. Too much money, as Dr. West already said, morally profane that we'd spend $6 billion. So too much money, too much time. I think, you know, we got to get to a point of rethinking how we do presidential politics in this country, from the Electoral College to the money to the debates. But too much time spent on the campaign. It used to be that the campaigning would stop and the governing would start. Now there's no line between the two. And thirdly, too many lies told. And these are examples, again, of the lies that we heard in this campaign. The fact checkers had to work overtime in this campaign to try to get the truth to the American people. So a campaign of extremes. It's time for us to rethink how we do presidential politics. But again, if this is the storyline that they want to run, let them run it, because they're going to run themselves into oblivion with this.
You know, but the lie at the lie at the center of both of them, Brother Rush and Brother Bill, the white liberal establishment is not a majority. The elite white liberal establishment is a minority. The white poor is not part of that. The white working class is not part of that. If you really want to talk about being dependent on government, $16 trillion for Wall Street, not one of them going to jail involved in criminal activity linked to predatory lending, market manipulation, or insider trading. The government protects them. Jamal gets caught with a crackback, he going to jail. But Mr. McGillicuddy gets caught on Wall Street, he's protected by the government. Neither administration, Bush, Obama, have any investigations, no prosecutions at all. So the folk who are really dependent, they get interest-free loans for the Federal Reserve. Wouldn't it be nice if students could get interest-free loans? So Rush and Bill, they got to tell the truth. The white elite is very dependent on government. They get welfare anytime they want it with no strings attached. So that's the lie at the center of both of their views. Uh-huh. And it's not majority. White brothers and sisters are catching hell who are not part of the 1%.
I wanted to go to the issue of the whole discussion that you're engaged in pushing President Obama from the left. In September, at the Democratic Convention, mm-hmm. Democracy Now! Hosted a debate on Obama's record with Glenn Ford, executive editor of Black Agenda, and Michael Eric Dyson, the author and MSNBC analyst, Georgetown University professor. This is what Michael Eric Dyson had to say.
The reality is that the American left will never be able to participate, not simply in the pageantry of American politics and the light and airy stuff that conventions engage in, of course, the fluff and the desiderata may be absolutely true, as Mr. Ford has indicated. But the reality is that Obama is as progressive a figure who has the chance of being elected in America. Friedrich Engels is not going to be the Secretary of Labor, and Marx will not be the Secretary of Treasury. Bottom line. But if you ain't in the game, Miami Heat is playing the, it's talking about sports, is playing the Oklahoma Thunder. It's not, I'd prefer it be the Los Angeles Lakers. This is the game we're talking about. And if the American left can't be involved in the actual practice of government to offer the critical and salient insights that are available, take 2000 when siding with Nader, then Al Gore, who should have been president, who would have prevented some of the stuff that we see now happening, didn't occur. The left won't take responsibility for the fact that with the extraordinary intelligence of a Glenn Ford and many other leftists notwithstanding, the reality is that he's the most progressive president, as Gary Dorian, an American leftist who teaches at Union Theological Seminary, argues, since FDR.
That's author, professor, commentator Michael Eric Dyson. Tavis Smalley, your response.
I've known Michael Eric Dyson for a long time, and I love him with all of my heart. It is so disappointing, though, to hear Michael, Professor Dyson, advance that kind of argument. He comes out of a black prophetic tradition that is rooted in speaking truth to power, and I might add to the powerless. But to somehow try to suggest in any way that this president has been progressive or is the best example of progressivism that we could put forth in this country, it's just inaccurate. This is precisely why Dr. West and I and others, you know, we don't have a monopoly on the truth, and we're not the only ones. But this is why we believe that the president has to be pushed. I've said so many times across the nation that great presidents aren't born, they're made. They have to be pushed into their greatness. There is no Abraham Lincoln. I just saw the movie coming out this weekend, I think, The Lincoln Project. And Lincoln isn't Lincoln if Frederick Douglass isn't pushing him. FDR isn't FDR if A. Philip Randolph and Eleanor Roosevelt aren't pushing him. LBJ isn't LBJ if MLK isn't pushing him. And so what I hear in Professor Dyson's critique is that there is some excuse to be made or that we have to settle for this as the best example of progressivism that we can find. And Doc and I just don't believe in settling. We don't believe in making excuses. We believe that if he is not pushed, he's going to be a transactional president and not a transformational president. And we believe that the time is now for action and no longer accommodation. But that doesn't happen unless you're pushed. So the excuse making and the settling for the fact that this is the best that we can do. Can you imagine where this country would be if women had settled? This is the best that we can do. If black folk in slavery and segregation have said this is the best that we can do, that's not even the spirit of America, much less the spirit of those who come out of the black prophetic traditions. That's disappointing to hear, even though I love him with all my heart.
And Brother Tavis is being very kind, because he's right. I love Brother Mike Dyson, too. But we're living in a society where everybody's up for sale. Everything's up for sale. And he and Brother Sharpton and Sister Melissa and others, they have sold their souls for a mess of Obama pottage. And we invite them back to the black prophetic tradition after Obama leaves. But at the moment, they want insider access, and they want to tell those kind of lies. They want to turn their back to poor and working people.
Well,
and it's a sad thing to see them as apologists for the Obama administration in that way, given the kind of critical background that all of them have had at some point.
Michael Eric Dyson isn't saying that Obama is progressive, but he's the most progressive of the presidents that we've had.
When FDR says, bring the economic ruralists on, there, my foes, I'm fighting on behalf of poor people. Has Obama not just said that, but done that? Did LBJ, who declared a war on poverty that generated the kind of legislation against American terrorism called Jim and Jane Crow for voting and... Come on, Dyson. But it's not just what he said there. It's what he's been saying as a whole. Brother Glenn Ford crushed him in that debate. Listen to what the arguments are. You see what I mean? And again, we said it out of love for Dyson because he's been our partner and he can be our partner again. But these kind of lies we can't live with.
And to be the most progressive, I want to add right quick, to be the most progressive means that you've taken some serious risk.
That's right.
And I just don't see the example of that. Even in the health care debate, the president compromised against himself. He watered down what he promised on the campaign trail before we got serious. The promise of an open debate on C-SPAN never really quite materialized. So I'm not suggesting that I'm unhappy with the fact that we got something done on health care, but it's nowhere near what it was supposed to be. And again, if you're going to label somebody the most progressive, you got to show me where the risk was taken. Lincoln took risk. FDR took risk. LBJ took risk. We know famously, LBJ said, I know that advancing this legislation, voting rights and civil rights, is going to lose my party, the South, for two decades. And he turned out to be right. But it was the right thing to do at that time. And so that's what we're saying. In the president's forward motion in the second term to establish a legacy, and I don't think that being president ought to be about a legacy, ought to be about advancing the best for the American people. But in this conversation about his legacy, I want to see what risk he's going to take. Is he going to put himself on the line for poor people? Is he going to have an honest conversation about drones, as Doc said earlier? You know, is he going to ever say the word president, the phrase prison industrial complex? Reagan wouldn't say AIDS. Bush wouldn't say climate change. Will Obama say prison industrial complex? I mean, I want to know where the risk is that equates to being the most progressive president ever. I don't get that.
Is it progressive to sign the National Defense Authorization Act in which you can actually detain American citizens with no due process, no judicial process, to assassinate American citizens based on executive power? That is authoritarian. That's autocratic. It's crypto-fascist. We have to call it for what it is. Drones are war crimes. We have to call it for what it is. That's the tradition that produced us. That's what Frederick Douglass is about. That's what Ida B. Wells is about. That's what Abraham Joshua Heschel at his best was. That's what Dorothy Day was. That's our tradition. Now, if one doesn't want to be part of that tradition and be inside of the White House, then stay in the White House and have a good time and break dance. But don't lie. Don't try to tell us that lies are the truth.
We're going to come back to this conversation in a minute. Our guests are Tavis Smiley and Dr. Cornel West.
I don't want no Glenn Beck is a racist. Gaza Strip was getting bombed. Obama didn't say shit.
After you divorce yourself from the right-wing propaganda campaign, it's all simple and plain. America could stand the game. Your president got an African name. Now who you gon' blame when they drop them bombs out of them planes using depleted uranium? Babies looking like two-headed aliens. Follow the money trail that leads to the criminal. And nothing subliminal to it. That's how they do it. See the game they running. Give a fuck if he's cunning, articulate, and handsome. Afghanistan held for ransom by the hand of this black man. Neo-colonial puppet. White power with a black face. He said, fuck it, I'll do it. A master of disguise. Expert at telling lies. Then they gave him a Nobel Peace Prize. Should have known he was trained in Chicago. Word to Chairman Fred and Mark Clark. What they do in the dark will come out in the light. Like a WikiLeaks site. So I guess Nkrumah was right. Who's ready to fight? Last stage of imperialism. I ain't kidding. In the immortal words of Marvin Gaye, this ain't living.
Obama, Obama nation. I'm not gonna Obama. Gaza Strip was getting bombed, Obama didn't say shit.
O-B-A-M-A, you ain't fooling everyone, I see the games you play. You was VIP at the BIC, and we know that's the code name for CIA. Hey. The same way your cameras are watching us, we're watching you. Think we're easy to control, you ain't got a clue. Revolution's on the way, let's see what you're gonna do. You're gonna send the troops, you're gonna drop the nukes. See, it's not where you're from, it's where you're at. He's sitting in the White House, so who cares if he's black? And why is there soldiers still out there in Iraq? Natural resources ain't yours, it's theirs, give it back. You're just another puppet, but I'm not surprised. Look at Colin Powell and Condoleezza Rice. They didn't change shit, house niggas fresh off the slave ship. You all burn in hell, even Michelle Obama Nation.
Gaza Strip was getting bombed, Obama didn't say shit.
What's the bigger threat from Osama or from Obama? Military bases from Chagos to Okinawa. I say things that other rappers won't say, cause my mind never closed like Guantanamo Bay. Hope you didn't build a statue or tattoo your arm, cause the drones are still flying over Pashtunistan. Did he defend the war?
No.
He extended more, even had the time to attempt a coup in Ecuador. Morales and Chavez, the states are on a hunt for ya. Military now stationed on bases in Colombia. Take a trip to the past and tell them I was right. Ask Ali Abu Nima and Jeremiah Wright. Drones over Pakistan, Yemen and Libya. Is Obama the bomber getting ready for Syria? First black president, the masses were hungry, but the same president just bombed an African country like...
Gaza Strip was getting bombed, Obama didn't say shoot.
The Jonas Brothers are here. They're out there somewhere. Sasha and Malia are huge fans. But boys don't get any ideas. I have two words for you. Predator drones. You will never see it coming. You think I'm joking?
Back in the USSR, we'll be back after this short break.
Hi, I'm Sabelle. I am on CFRU 93.3 FM, and you can be too.
Kultrun World Music Festival is happening this summer in Kitchener from July 9th to July 12th, with free performances and events throughout the weekend. The festival is the Tri-City's only family-friendly celebration of diversity and will be the only satellite celebration of the Pan Am and Parapan Games, featuring Ana Tiju, Chico Trujillo, Los Ban Ban, Lucho Quequesana, and much more. There will also be all-ages interactive activities, workshops, storytelling, theater, and food and craft market. Come say hi to the CFRU crew who will be broadcasting live on location during the festival. This year's festival will be held on the green grounds of Victoria Park, a physically accessible location. For more information, visit nerudaarts.ca. Remember, that's this summer in KW from July 9th to July 12th. Ahí nos vemos!
Pour les francophones et francophiles de la région, CFRU diffuse l'Éclipse, l'émission musicale française à tous les vendredis de 9h à 10h le matin. Si vous faites partie d'une groupe ou une organisation francophone locale qui veut se faire distinguer ou bien vous voulez contribuer à notre programme, s'il vous plaît, me contacter, Sandra Doucette, par courriel francophone@cfru.ca. Soyez à l'écoute tous les vendredis de 9h à 10h pour les annonces des événements, d'actualité et bien sûr la bonne musique française.
Hi, I'm Dan Evans, and I volunteer at CFRU because it introduces me to amazing new ideas, and they're usually housed in amazing new people.
Hi, my name is Mina, and I volunteer on CFRU because I get to tell people about things that are going on in Canada that people wouldn't normally hear about.
My name is Kyle, and I volunteer at CFRU to connect with a wonderful group of diverse people.
If you would like to get involved with CFRU, contact Christopher at 519-824-4120, extension 58341, or volunteer at cfru.ca.
Hey, listen to the Back in the USSR here on 93.3 FM CFRU. So before the break, we heard from Loki, Obama Nation, and we heard from Cornel West and Tavis Smiley talking on Democracy Now about, really about, the kind of policies that Obama is pursuing and how they're not progressive, you know, which I think is very clear, like, you know, given his record since 2008. He really hasn't made virtually any concession to working people whatsoever in the United States, or made things easier for them, made things easier for, you know, his own people, like African-Americans, you know. It's just he kind of just taken them for granted the whole time. And, you know, and that's basically what Cornell and Tavis are talking about, you know. And while we're on this kind of, like, talk about, on the subject of, you know, austerity, you know, where you have, like, kind of, like, the rollback of all these social programs, the cutting of wages, you know, giving all kinds of bailout money to the banks, to the corporations, all this kind of stuff. You know, that's becoming the norm, like, around the world right now. You know, and fortunately I had a chance to talk to progressive author Michael Parenti. This is the first time I've had him on the show in, like, a long time, like, at least like a few years, like before I was in China. And I talked to him about this this phenomenon. This is what he had to say. Like, we did a 30-minute interview. And I'm sure you'll find, like, what he has to say very, very interesting. So I'm going to play that for you right now. Please stay tuned to Back in the USSR. Okay, hello, everyone. You're listening to Back in the USSR here on 93.3 FM CFRU. We are speaking to Dr. Michael Parenti, progressive author and scholar based in Berkeley, California. And we're going to talk to him about his recent book, which I believe just came out in April of this year. It's called Profit Pathology and Other Indecencies. And you can read more of Michael's stuff at michaelparenti.org. And I'll mention that again later on. So, hello, Michael. How's it going?
Hello. How are you, Siegfried?
Pretty good. It's been a while since we last talked, so I'm glad we got this opportunity to do so, especially in light of, well, I mean, just everything that's been going on in the world now, and, like, the appropriate timing, I think, of this this book you've just put out. So,
thank you.
Yeah, if we maybe could just kind of launch right into things. My first question is basically if you could just outline what is austerity.
Well, austerity is the imposition, the imposing upon the working people scarcity and hardship. And that's done by those at the top who work us
mm-hmm.
and who have all sorts of political rallies where they talk about the loafers and the lazy people and who don't want to work and that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
So they blame, the poor are always blamed for their own poverty. They are seen as the authors of their own poverty when in fact that's not true. And the truth is that wealth creates poverty. In many instances, poverty is the creation by wealth. I mean, slaves wasn't their laziness. They put in 18-hour days of toil of all kinds, and the plantation owners' wealth and luxury and accumulation was from the exploitation of the poor. So that's how you get wealth. A few people will expropriate the land and labor and resources of everybody else. That's one of the points one has to make. Well, mm-hmm. what was it you were asking again?
Well, this is what is austerity, basically, right? Like, of course, we're hearing this term, like, all the time these days, like about austerity, the need for austerity. It's like the language, the chosen language, you could say, of the elite, which is kind of imposing this. And you see in Europe, we see in North America, we see like really all over the world now since the recession.
Don't, they don't want to say homelessness and hunger and no access to medical care.
Right.
You know, they call it austerity. You know, like learn to curb and don't be a freeloader and all that. When in fact, it's the rich. It's that 1% or one fraction of 1% at the top that is really the freeloader. Nobody goes to the government for more handouts than the very, very super rich. They they have enormous amounts of policies and programs for their own benefit. If I don't lose my voice here, I think you got my point.
Oh, absolutely. Well, I mean, it's and it almost seems like austerity is almost like a feature of the capitalist system in general. It's just the word maybe has kind of come into vogue, but I mean, they've been doing this for a long time, right?
Yeah, they most certainly have been doing it for a long time. Yes, that's correct. Yes. And whenever there was a set of circumstances at World War II that changed things around a bit. We came out of a deep depression that had lasted about 15 years. I mean, the New Deal did a lot of good things, but, you know, it never really got the U.S. out of its depression. And then came the war.
Mm-hmm.
The war was actually a lot of good-paying jobs for people. The ruling class spent amounts of money to kill people and destroy towns and cities, an amount that it would not spend in peacetime to get people out of the depression. But that war got people out of the depression. 9 million American men, mostly men, almost all men, came back from the war, and there was a GI Bill that was passed for them. And that was a remarkable thing, because unlike the GI Bill today, where where veterans have to also get a job on the side or take out student loans or whatever else, the GI Bill does not help them the way it promised to really do. But in those days, it did, and it also gave money for small businesses to start and all that. So there was a tremendous burst of prosperity, of spending. there was a pileup of money that people had from 4 years of working in the defense plants where they couldn't spend that money because all those factories were not making refrigerators and stoves and cars. They were making bombs and planes and tanks and things of that sort. So this combination of things, plus there was not a stripping down, and there was a big stripping down of the military, of course, but a substantial military was kept going 1946-47 because of the Cold War was starting. The Red Army was on the Elbe. The big communist parties in France and Italy. The workers in Western Europe were developing social democracies. They were getting free medical care. They were getting job programs, free education, these things. That they were doing that because people in Eastern Europe were getting the same kinds of things, and it was a sort of a historic compromise which we had to, keep up with the Reds.
Right.
And here in the communist countries, people spent only one tenth of their salary for rent. They had free medical care. They had free education up to the highest level of their abilities. They had very subsidized and improved transportation, and all these kind of things were happening. So the West had to do some of the same things, and it was what were being built then in those days was you had a well-being that had never existed quite like that before in the West. And that's when the mythology also emerged that America's the land of prosperity. And for whatever prosperity, they really advertised it and ideologized it I can create a word. It was part of the ideology that only in America everybody's got a car now, and the whole transportation infrastructure was built with government money, people's public money, to subsidize the automotive industry, and these super highways were built and all of that at public expense for the trucking industry and the automotive industry's benefit. And this went on and on, and then when you got to the late 70s, early 80s, they started turning it all around. Reagan came in, and there was the feeling was enough is enough. We've got to roll this back, and they've done a terrific job of doing just that thing. And so you now have that great prosperous middle class that we always heard about and all that, now much pitied and much. Rolled back and going broke in many instances.
So of course we see this kind of momentary historical compromise that now is being clawed back, and I guess austerity is the latest incarnation, at least of the language of that rollback.
Right, austerity and impoverishment and oppression; those were the normal conditions of capitalism in the United States all through the 1800s and the early 1900s and right up until the late part of the 20th century, the 80s or so is a turnaround. And you get more and more of it today. Today mm-hmm. you have students graduating college with $75,000 debts, You have the same rollback going on, of course, now in Eastern Europe.
Mm-hmm, that's true.
They don't owe the working class anything anymore. They just started rolling them back. And Richard Pipes, of all people, I mean, a conservative like him, I'll give him credit. He didn't suppress the study, but he did the study of all the former communist countries. How things are. And it came out overwhelmingly, people saying it was better under communism.
Mm-hmm.
Better under communism, The farmers would say it was better. We got subsidies. We could sell our stuff and this and that. And students, it was better for them. It was better for public transportation was better. The healthcare system was more equitable, more accessible. And you can go on. So that's what they're really. The whole game is really a class struggle game. That's what it is.
Yeah. If I could go back to something you mentioned very briefly before, was just how war is now being tied in with austerity. You see, with austerity now, you see increased rise of interventions of basically the American military and Western military forces abroad. And increased violence around the world, and increased interventions and these kind of things. So how does that really, imperialism, tie in with austerity?
Well, imperialism, the empire feeds off the republic. I mean, where does an empire get its operational wealth from? From the republic, from the mm-hmm. people. You got to tax the American public. How do you get to tax them, and so that you have a federal budget every year in which 52% is for military purposes? Right there, that's just 52% off the top, and not to mention a lot of other things, military pensions, all sorts of other stuff. But so the way you do that is you convince your public that this is for their safety. We have to control the world, or the world will devour us. And so we've been seeing it again and again and again. Imperialism is an extension, an outgrow of capitalism, but it's also a way of making the world safe for the plutocracy. That's really its great goal. And to provide places for investment and further profit at greater margins than before.
Yeah, and I guess this kind of goes into the whole profit pathology, right? Because, I mean, I think you even said in one of your talks, you know, the whole idea that capitalism can never stay home. Like, it has to keep expanding. And if it doesn't expand, I mean, basically it collapses, right? So, I mean, like imperialism and capitalism, I guess, go hand in hand with regard to that.
It's a mad system. That's why I said pathology. I mean, yeah, it is a mad system. It's designed to pay workers as little as possible and yet hope that there'll be many workers with lots of spending power to pick up all these commodities and services that I'm creating by the, with these underpaid workers, you know. And my hope is that some other owner will give their workers enough money so they'll have the money to buy up the goods and services that my underpaid workers are creating. But the other owners have the same idea, and they, too, underpay their workers. And so there's a chronic overproduction. There's a chronic underconsumption. Even though we have a big consumer society, there's all sorts of crap that you got more things, you know, consumer items and gizmos, and even in the area of food, where the food is, I mean, some of the fast food stuff is uneatable, but there it is, and expensive and cheap in some cases. But so imperialism is the outgrowth of capitalism. War brings a false prosperity, you know, and socialism. What imperialism is socialism coming to the rescue again. Capitalism is always rescued by the government. I mean, the number of programs, the programs of research and development in all sorts of areas, the railroad industry, the mining industry, the steel industry, the airline industry, the internet industry, and all these things are publicly owned. That plutocratic class that constantly denounces the government, constantly scolds the American people, as you're saying, austerity. Stop looking for a handout from the government. Stop running off to the government with silly, wasteful things like Social Security and Medicare. And all. If I didn't have those, I'd be out on the street right now myself, I'm telling No, it's not funny.
So, well, I mean, there's a lot of people, right? Like, who face that.
Yeah, yeah. And as I said before, the irony is, of course, that same plutocracy goes to the government. I mean, owns the government. I mean, gets more subsidies. Agribusiness, trillions of dollars in subsidies. Pharmaceuticals, trillions. The medicine industry. And now with Obamacare, you've got the health insurance industry piping up their racket. It's gotten more. It's given people more services, but it has been a. But these guys get their shakedown before we ever see any services.
Yeah, and I guess this is the real face of the capitalist state, right? The state serving the capitalist class, like these, you know, the Fortune 500. I guess you could say serving their interests and not the interests of the people.
That's correct. It ends up serving their interests. They'll take any good program or need that's needed. They'll argue against it. They'll denounce it. But then they'll put through a version of it where they end up walking away with enormous profits. I don't think you have to engage in a big ideological struggle against the capitalists or imperialists, at least with people when trying to convince them. What I did in this book, Profit Pathology, is I suggested a very simple empirical approach to, rather than an ideological struggle of grand isms, you know, my superism against your superism or whatever, and just do empirical choices. Just look at things. I say, let's have socialism wherever socialism works better than capitalism. Well, we've been taught that socialism's a flop and it doesn't work, and that's that. But, you know, public utilities work much better than private utilities. The rates are cheaper, the service is better, You don't have CEOs who are making $2, 3, 4 million a year as a CEO of the utility. You don't have all the kickbacks and whatever else. Mm-hmm. We have a private utility here in California, PG&E, which brought death to users in San Bruno, where people in San Bruno were smelling gas and complaining and saying there's a gas leak somewhere here, and the company didn't. The company is too busy scooping up profits for itself, and it blew up, and 8 people were killed, and another 35 were seriously hurt, and about 40 or 50 houses. If you had seen the photos, I don't know if you ever got them there. They were staggering. These houses were just blown right off their foundations, just nothing there, torn apart like a tornado or something. So public utilities are better. The rates are lower. Your surplus doesn't go to stockholders to enrich them. Your surplus goes into the public budget, and that helps the taxpayers a little, you know. Let's look at schools. Public schools, public universities are better than private ones. The idea that we now have more and more private for-profit universities, for-profit. The school admits that it creates this university to make profits for its shareholders, not for education. Well, again, it would be a lot cheaper if you just have a public university, that you don't have to be producing large amounts of wealth for the shareholders. All the money goes back into the school. How about public medicine, public health care, public hospitals? Mm-hmm. They're better. And the things that public transportation is so much more efficient, so much better for the environment and the like. Public transportation here carts more people than the congestion and slaughter of cars does. So what do we do for capitalism? Maybe restaurants we can say, it's better that the restaurant is owned by mom and pop and they really have the little touch to it than having the state. Judging from my experience with restaurants in socialist countries, I might lean in that direction. So what I'm saying is, instead of getting into an isms fight, let's just go with social function by social function and say, well, what's been better? What's been better? Tell us, really.
Yeah, like just kind of bring it down to like that empirical level, right? I mean, I have a similar story, actually. I mean, you were telling the story about what happened in California where, like, you know, those houses were blown away.
Yeah.
Once again, there's a result of that private company, and the cutbacks and all this kind of stuff. A similar thing happened in Ontario in the 1990s. In this case, it had to do with the privatization of water systems. And, this is something that definitely should be in the public domain. Needless to say.
If there's an accident with a public system,
yeah, this was
never an end to it, and you say, you see, these systems don't, it's not good, it doesn't work, and you should give it to a private company.
Yeah.
That's more, and they immediately elevate it into an ism thing, you know, and so forth.
Yeah.
But it's not true when it happens to them, when you got the BP blowing up oil floats and destroying half of New Orleans and all that, they just say, oh, that was an accident.
Yeah,
they don't raise the question of, is this the way capitalism operates? Well, this is terrible. This is life-threatening. This is destroying our environment and our city and our people. They don't say that. They just say, oh, well, there's been an accident. We got to clean it up. Oh.
Mm-hmm.
And then the cleanup goes to social.
Oh, right, yeah.
Also, and they have to pay for it.
Mm-hmm. Like the public has to pay the cost every time, right? I mean, in the Ontario case, it was a town called Walkerton.
Yes.
And basically this place, they had privatized the water system. And because
it was
the
private one, you said, Siegfried, I didn't hear you.
Yeah, they privatized the water system there.
Oh.
And basically what ended up happening is it got contaminated by E. coli lack of oversight and this kind of stuff.
Yeah.
About like 8 people ended up dead, like hundreds more got sick, and most of the people who died were kids, right?
Oh my God.
So like this kind of thing like happened. There was a big scandal back in like 1995.
Did they put it under public ownership again, or it's still privately owned?
Well, I mean, these days it's like kind of more of like a public-private kind of partnership or whatever it is they call it. I mean, basically it's like maybe some increased like oversight, but it's mostly like in the private domain still.
Yeah.
And there's like a lot of privatization going on now. I know the hydro system's about to get privatized and sold off right up here. It's a big big thing. I mean, some people are being mobilized around it right now. Because that was the next thing I was actually going to ask you about. Like, how are people fighting back against these kind of policies, which are very, very anti-worker, anti-public in general?
Well, they get angry about certain things. You know, PG&E, the company I was telling you about, they were given $42 million. Again, socialism supporting capitalism. Gave them money to rebuild all various pipelines that were had problems, were brittle, leaking, or chipping, or showing signs of being being ready to blow up or something. Mm-hmm. They did all that, but it didn't really, you know, it wasn't used. It wasn't used for those purposes. PG&E took that money and waged a campaign, a statewide referendum, to prohibit any kind of public utilities in the state of California. They spent millions. They spent millions of dollars on this campaign, and miracle of miracles, they lost anyway. The people did not want to hand over all the utilities to the private profiteers. And well, I deal with these things in my book. Some of those things, and I also talk about in my book Private Pathology and Other Indecencies. I also talk about how small little things, or you talk about austerity. How about Holocaust? How about extermination? 12 to 18 million native indigenous peoples in North America, who and 500 language groups were all destroyed from what, 1600 to 1890, almost three centuries.
Mm-hmm.
Just destruction to take an immense fortune from them, an immense fortune of mineral deposits, of water, forests, lands, topsoil. I mean, a huge enriched continent taken over, stolen, and killing the people, exterminating the people who are on the land, you know. And that's another thing. And then the immense capital accumulation from slavery, which people don't usually talk about, but you know, cotton was probably the greatest value production of any. I mean, more than coal, more than iron, more than just about anything else for quite a while. It was, and again, that was on the labor of African slaves, people who were brought in here and enslaved in terrible ways. This is the so-called primitive accumulation, mm-hmm. indeed primitive, I would say, murderously primitive. And I guess the story I'm saying is, the system is an amazing system of horrors and abuses and murder and destruction and
mm-hmm.
holocausts, and it's all sort of normal. The crises of capitalism, just about every few years, there's a crisis, there's a panic, there's a drop, there's recessions, and it's still going on to this very day. There's still a recession going on right now.
Mm-hmm. And so would you say like people are increasingly waking up to the reality of the system here?
I don't know. There certainly are many who are just as stupid and blind to it and bought into it as ever. They watch Fox News and they get roped in. But there are people who are seeing. Look at the protests of the Occupy movement. That was very unusual for the U.S. anyway. Probably better in Canada. I think ideologically somewhat more developed in Canada than they are in the United States. But, although there could be plenty of work done there too, and even in Europe, I mm-hmm. think the Europeans were so far ahead and sophisticated. The more I spoke in Europe and went, I realized, my gosh, they got some of the wool has been pulled over their eyes too. In some instances, you know. So Yeah, it's just got a lot. There's just an awful. Where the wake up was with the Occupy movement. It was just that one little phrase, 1% versus 99%.
Right.
So suddenly the great divide that you and I and others have been trying to get across and say, look, there's a great divide here, financially, ideologically, anyway. And then developing it a little more, and you say, wait, it's not 1%. 1% of the American population is 3 million people. No, they're not super rich. You can be up there in the top 3 million with $200,000 a year, and you're up in that bracket almost. This is like a fraction of 1%. You know, it's a hundredth of 1%. That the super rich have never been more unequal among themselves than they are today. And in other words, in America, in any case, we still don't even realize, we don't know how rich the super rich really are. Look at these homes up on the hill here in Berkeley, and then they go for $2 million, and they're very nice homes indeed. I would never be able to afford such a place, but that's not rich, you know. That could be a professor with tenure and some smart investments could probably float a house like that or something. The very rich are people who live in places where you don't see their front yards that easily, because there's a gate and there's a great estate and there's a special pad for a helicopter or a private plane, and they live really very different.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, I mean, there certainly has been people waking up, though. I mean, like, I've been quite impressed by the campaigns for raising the minimum wage, which are, like, in a lot of U.S. cities now, and a lot of, like, low-wage workers, like, from McDonald's even, like, who, you know, most people wouldn't even see them going out on strike, but they're going out on strike. And there's, like, been quite a few actions. Like, it seems like a lot of places. And even in Ontario now, like, we're starting to see, you know, raise the minimum wage to $15. Like, that's becoming a pretty big thing now.
Yes, and as I say, it gets back to that madness and that contradiction of not paying the people who you need as customers. You know?
It's true, you know. And another thing, of course, like Indigenous peoples. I mean, we talked about that before, all the things that they've suffered at the hands of, like, you know, they say primitive accumulation, and they're increasingly politically active. You know, like they, you might have even seen the picture from this when I was in Washington D.C. A few months ago, right? And, like, you know, they raised the Mohawk flag outside the White House, and these were people who were coming down in support of Ecuadorian activists who were campaigning against Chevron, you know, what it's done to the Ecuadorian rainforest.
Yeah.
You know, and the devastation that it's caused down there, right? So, I mean, you see these – I mean, that was some very real international solidarity there, and you also had, like, the Indigenous dynamic in there as well, and it was very amazing to be a part of that.
And sometimes it does reach a point where the oppression can be so extreme that the people who are oppressed have no choice but to fight back. And I mean, when you think of it, who the hell can live on $7 an hour? I mean,
it's true.
At least in this country, the way prices are, the prices are still going up. You know,
mm-hmm.
Gas went down, big deal. Well, that's something, but it's really a shame. It's a shame. It's an insult. It's an offense to people's humanity. It is. So that's what the book is about. I wrote a lot of stuff in there, and it's only 150 pages. But I sort of had fun packing it in. I shouldn't say have fun. Sometimes it was with a painful grimace, but that's the way it goes.
Mm. Well, yeah, I mean, this is some pretty serious serious stuff we're talking about here, right?
Yes, indeed.
This book, once again, like, sounds very interesting. I know I'm going to try to read it as soon as I can. And this is Profit Pathology and Other Indecencies,
mm-hmm.
which I think you – who publishes that?
It was it's Rutledge and Paradigm Publishers.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
All right. And once again, like, your website is michaelparenti.org.
That's correct.
Yeah, so if people want to like read more of your articles or find out about more of your books, mm-hmm. you know, just they can go and check that out. Well,
yes, thank you.
Mm-hmm. And I guess probably what we should end on is Antonio Gramsci's quote. You know, just if all we've talked about, you know, we must have a pessimism of the mind, but an optimism of the will.
Right.
Right. I know you've said that many times, and I know I've certainly tried to take that one to heart. You know, given what we're up against, but what these struggles that we have to basically face, what we have to go through.
Mm-hmm.
It's very important. All right. So, Michael Parenti, thank you very much for joining us today on Back in the USSR. I really appreciate this.
Thank you, Siegfried. Thank you.
Okay. I'll talk to you soon. All right.
Right. Sure.
Thanks. Okay.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Yeah. 1, 2, 1, 2. Flow combat, B, I born that, beaches storm that, reformat the masses, I'm redrafting the battle maps at top of task list, I build a classic boom bap blast, bazooka rap shit, I'm sending heads into backspin, attack with wind at the back, plus vernaculars to dig it back by facts, packed with the stat charts and graphs, I got passion, burn mics up to ashes, I make flashes, crapped in pantses, stanzas, cure culture. Cerebral cancer, I got tunes that move you to dance, burn flags, anthem, throw a tantrum, getting out of hand with these random acting tactics against the axis, my word act like nominally got, rhymingly packed, punch, crash the fun by metric tons, and plus my math, distribute cash among the classes, take from the thieving greedy bastard, get back like church has to get past, collapse structure, fuck for swords, I destruct the support beams and bars, wrecking ball, large, resistance, subversive diction, flip the shit just like a brick throne, dethrone kings, bring the trees on, my tone rock like Gibraltar pop, hip hop hotter than a rocket shot, I'm crime, think, thought, bring the big talk, teach you to flee from the flock, walk off, switch shit, hit my target, drop like bombs in the form of carpets, I got the target locked on that all shit. Pump your fist if you know where we are. That's a rap. Boom bap. Original rap at. Taking shit back. Boom bap. Boom bap. Talking true path, master the craft, the pupil, the prof, keep dropping math, boom bap, blast the bazooka rap.
My name is Mahmouda, and you are listening to CFRU 93.3 FM.
For your own pleasure, a well-hidden treasure, Pizza Chocadero. We serve delicious gourmet pizza with daily made dough, homemade sauce, and fresh toppings cut by hand. Ask us for our 2-1 special. Pizza Chocadero, open weekdays till 9, weekends until 10. Located at 7 Municipal, north of College in Edinburgh. Proud to be an independent family-owned business. Call 519-829-2444 or visit trocadero.ca.
Hi, my name is Peter, and I volunteer at CFRU because it's a space that really encourages creativity and expressing yourself.
My name is Stacy. I love discovering music that sounds good to me. All kinds of music.
I love the people, I love the atmosphere, and everyone loves radio, and you can tell.
If you love radio and would like to get involved, volunteer at CFRU. No previous experience is required, and we provide all the training. Check out our website at cfru.ca or call Christopher at 519-824-4120, extension 58341, or email volunteer@cfru.ca.
Volunteering at CFRU breeds minds, breeds culture. So come on down.
Aerobics. Gonna stretch your mind.
Your life.
Tuesday morning. Your life. 7 to 9. CFRU 93.3.
Looking to add a little spice to your day? Come stop by Caribbean Cuisine on 45 Cork Street East. Open Mondays to Saturdays from 11 a.m. to 8 p.m. and late nights on Fridays and Saturdays from 12:30 a.m. to 3 a.m. Caribbean Cuisine provides an extensive menu which includes Guelph's best rotzi, jerk chicken, goat, oxtail curry, beans, doubles, and more, all for amazing prices. That's Caribbean Cuisine, an authentic taste.